All right, welcome back to Your Turn. My name is Kenneth E. Lamb, your host today. Co-hosting with me, Jerry Gordon. He is our military affairs analyst. Jerry, I'm going to go ahead and, as we said before, you have Mr. Ted Bellman with us, I believe, from Ontario. John Shanzar, live from Washington, D.C. And, Jerry, I'm going to let you go ahead and let's get this three-way conversation going between you.
By having the two gentlemen, Ted Bellman in Toronto and John Shanzar, react and discuss further two items. One was a comment made by the spokesperson today during a news conference that I participated in with a gentleman by the name of Mark Regev. He's the international media advisor to Prime Minister Olmert, who's leaving office on February 10th, hopefully. The issue that Regev had as a central message is that there was a new reality of security created in the south of Israel. And that leads me to a question of what next is going to occur. Ted, do you want to start off?
Sure. The White House spokesperson, Gordon Jandro, articulated what this violence now is in terms of Israel fighting back and defending itself is all about. And he said, in order for the violence to stop, Hamas must stop firing rockets into Israel and agree to respect a sustainable and durable ceasefire. Now, that's like suggesting Hamas should have a lobotomy, because it's inconsistent with who they are. So, really, what the one wonders what the whole object of this is, and many people who are quite familiar with the scene say all this shock and awe means nothing unless you actually destroy Hamas. And I tend to think that the object of this exercise, first of all, that it's in total agreement tactically and strategically between Israel and the U.S. They're on the same page and they have the same agenda. And that agenda is to facilitate forward movement in the peace process. And Hamas was always preventing that from happening. And the hope is that if we can neuter Hamas, we can allow the peace process to go forward. So I, for one, believe that the object really is to neuter Hamas.
John Shanzar, any difference of opinion or
result? Well, I basically agree with Ted, but I would probably present a few variations on this theme. Number one, I completely agree with the fact that the United States and Israel are 100% on the same page, and the statements coming out of Crawford, Texas today were very encouraging, as well as the statements from Foggy Bottom. But what I think is we need to focus on here is that even if this shock and awe campaign goes on for quite some time, it will not destroy Hamas entirely. The people who launch the rockets will still be there. The funding that comes in from Hamas will not cease. And the rockets that are smuggled underground from Egypt into the Gaza Strip will continue to come in no matter how much Israel does to prevent it. There will always be ways of bringing these rockets in, and they will fire some more. So at the end of the day, it does come down to completely destroying the Hamas organization. And my question is, does Israel have the will to do this? This would not be an easy thing to do, but I think Ted's right that the only way forward towards peace would be by the complete elimination of Hamas. It's just getting to that point is extremely difficult. I mean, deciding that Israel is going to go in and is going to root out the entire organization would be an extremely painful process and a long, laborious military campaign, and I don't know if the world is ready to see that.
Do either of you think that the Israel military establishment has learned the lessons that were created in the debacle in southern Lebanon in 2006 with his current campaign?
It's not so much the IDF learning the lessons, it's really the political establishment learning the lessons, and they have to have the right goals and the right agenda. And that's exactly what Jonathan is talking about, and I also, we don't know what the political agenda is in terms of are they willing to do what's necessary. That's still not clear.
I completely agree, Ted. And, you know, one of the things that we saw during the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah was that really the United Nations and the international community were able to dictate Israel when to stop the war. So whatever goals Israel may have had, they never achieved them. They were never able to truly neutralize the Iran-funded Hezbollah organization. What we need to see this time around is, you know, if we really want to see quiet in the region, is, you know, to allow Israel to achieve its goals, whatever those goals are, as the Israeli government dictates or lets the public know through, you know, releases and through their spokespeople. We need to listen very carefully to what it is that they're trying to achieve. And then I think our goal here in the United States is to support Israel to achieve those goals.
Do either of you think that the timing of the operation in Gaza had a political element?
Jerry, what we're going to need to do, gentlemen,
yes.
Ted and John, what we're going to have to do is, I've got 29 seconds. I've got to take a CNN news break. Now, gentlemen, I had a question come in to me from the station owner, and here's what he'd like to know, if you could handle this, please. Number one is, how significant is the timing of this attack to the fact that George Bush is still in office, with kind of the underwriting being that Obama would be much less likely to support this type of an operation? And then, as a corollary to that question, since Hamas is basically a proxy for Iran, and since Egypt has somewhat indicated, you know, its concern about Iran, of course, which really equates out to the Shiites, you know, taking over, be a threat to the Arab world, how much of this also then do you think is a prelude to get ready to go after Iran? And Jerry, I'll let you sort it out between your guests here with me, but those are the two things.
Well, actually, the question my good friend Mike Bates, the owner of the station, posed is a very timely one. And it goes to the question of, were there any political elements behind this operation in Gaza? Ted, you want to answer that?
Well, as I said earlier, I think this is all about furthering the peace process. So the lull in the last year since Annapolis started, both Israel and the United States didn't want anything to interfere with the process and with the negotiations. But here we are at a point where the negotiations have reached a standstill, where nothing more can be done, and everyone recognizes Hamas is a sticking point to negotiations. So the timing, I think, relates to the fact that the lull is over, elections are coming, and I don't think it has to do with Bush or Obama. Any American president would have supported this. So I think that's what drove it. They want to clean out Hamas to let the peace process go forward.
John, you have any opposite comment?
Well, a couple things I think are worth noting here. Number one, you know, the media has been repeating this notion that the ceasefire simply ended, and that's why we are seeing this uptick in violence. In reality, the ceasefire was actually declared by Hamas about 6 months ago. They declared this ceasefire in an attempt to really build up their military capabilities. And after this arbitrary period of 6 months ended, Hamas elected to end the ceasefire and to begin shelling Israel yet again. So the timing for this operation really coincides with Hamas's decision to bomb Israel with, you know, 60-plus rockets just in one day last week. And so Israel's response, I mean, Israel has been waiting for this. They've known that it was going to come. They weren't going to respond until Hamas really provoked them. And it just so happened that this happened, you know, before Bush left office. That said, I think it is important to note that Bush has been an incredibly strong advocate for Israel's right to defend itself. The statements coming out of Crawford today were, there was just, you know, no question about where he stood on this and where the State Department stands with regard to Israel's right to defend itself. And there are still some questions that remain about Obama. It's not to say that he's anti-Israel, as some might say, but really that, you know, he may try to take this tack where he says, well, you know, both sides need to demonstrate restraint. Both sides need to come back to the negotiating table. And I think Israel recognizes that if they really want to go in and rout out Hamas, this is probably the time to do it before there is even a question of whether the president-elect asks them to demonstrate restraint.
All right, and if we could, then I'd like to still keep the follow-up question, which is, how does this relate to the situation with Iran? Is this a prelude to basically take that flank out now and then get ready for Iran because they are proxies to the Iranians? Does it appear to you as though the Sunni Muslims, who have been very quiet for what you would expect them to do, now perceive a threat from the Shiites originating out of Iran. So, Jerry, if I could, I'd like to get all three of you to comment, please, on the Iranian connection.
My initial comment is a quote from Mr. Regev today, who said that the fingerprints of Iran were all over the Hamas activity in terms of supply of basic long-range rockets that have hit southern Israel, killed some people in great significant numbers, and also the fact that there's been training cadres that have taken Hamas people to other locations in the Middle East, Syria and others, for principal training for this kind of activity. One thing that you should note was a comment made that the fact that Hamas took a page out of Hezbollah's book from the 2006 war and engaged in massive underground bunkers, reinforced bunkers, and tunnels for the smuggling and also the launch of some of the longer-range missiles. John Chancer, do you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, well, you know, there's no question about it that this has been... there's no doubt in my mind that Iran is responsible for this round of violence. As a matter of fact, I believe that Hamas is so dependent upon Iran at this point that they probably would not have ended the ceasefire unless the mullahs had given them the okay to do so. And I think it's for that reason that we're seeing a coalition of Sunni Arab states condemning Hamas for ending the ceasefire and for renewing hostilities with Israel. And I think there's something else that we need to keep in mind, and it's not. I think we need to think of this less as is this the attack against Hamas? Does this represent a first wave of attacks against the Iran alliance or the Iran axis in the Middle East? I think the question is this really the first wave of Iranian attacks against Israel? There is a very good chance, and I've been reading about this in the Arab press as well as in the European press today, that there is a good chance that Hezbollah could get involved as well. In other words, Israel could be facing a two-front rocket war if we're not careful, if Iran determines that it's time to attack Israel from two fronts, possibly even three with some of the assets that it has in the West Bank. You could be looking at a much more dangerous war for Israel, and it could draw other actors in from the region, perhaps even the United States.
One observation is whether or not Syria, who is also a proxy of Iran, and a controlling party in what used to be Lebanon, basically would give its assent to that kind of activity on the northern frontier in Israel. Ted,
I have a bit of a different take.
Okay.
I don't see this so much as an offense by Iran through its proxies, but I think this is a corrective policy by the United States and Israel to correct the poor showing in the Lebanon War II. And what I think both Israel and the United States intend to do is roll Iran back. So to do that, when they take on Hamas in the fashion they have now, they certainly factored in the possibility that Hezbollah would join the fray. And I believe Israel is ready for that and probably wants it to happen so they can demolish both proxies and correct their earlier mistake. And I think that's all a prelude to the question of dealing with the atomic bomb.
Yeah, I'll just follow up on that. I think Ted is right in that respect. I was in Israel several months ago and had a chance to chat with a senior officer from the Air Force. And what he told me was that Israel is eager to reengage with Hezbollah. Not that they're looking for a war, but if they're provoked, they're ready. They would like to demonstrate to the world that that Israel can neutralize its enemies. Because really that war in 2006 was a horrible showing for the IDF. What we're looking at right now in Gaza is a sign of what could come in Lebanon as well. There are reports of what they call alpha hits of strikes inside Gaza where, pinpoint precision strikes with laser-guided munitions that are able to take out underground rocket launchers and weapons caches and other incredibly valuable targets for Iran and Hamas. I think, we will see more and more of that, and if Hezbollah is drawn into this or if Iran dispatches Hezbollah, we will see Israel do the same thing to its north in Lebanon.
If I may, I'd like to follow up for a minute on this with all three of you here. Okay, let's talk about Iran for a minute here. Shiite nation. Mr. Gordon has been on my show enough to know that my position on Islam is that essentially, as far as the Arab world goes, it's a death cult. You know, it's all about death. There's nothing about life in Islam over there. It's all about death. And the Shiites and the Sunnis are mortal enemies to each other. All of a sudden, the Shiites, who have always been the underclass, if you will, compared to the Sunnis over there, these guys are going to have the bomb. And when the U.S. pulls out of Iraq, a number of people feel as though that's one of the reasons, like al-Sadr has cooled off, is because basically when you got 60% of the population being Shiite, when you hold elections, guess who wins? So my question then is, would the Sunni nations, who perceive this threat and a possible nuclear threat from the Shiites through Iran, be encouraging Israel so that it's not just Israel that wants to take out the Shiites and the atomic facility, but also subliminally, or maybe not quite so sublime, you also have the Sunni Muslims basically saying, yeah, we need to do something before these Shiites take us out, because this is a blood war between us and them. Could I get your three reactions to that, please?
Well, I might start by saying that in the case of the Iranian nuclear threat, at the current moment, the United States and what is the current political leadership in Israel are basically alloyed, in the sense of we've got to be using tougher, quote, diplomatic and economic sanctions against Iran to bring them to the table. The recent drop-off in oil prices, as a case in point, may have had a significant impact, but it hasn't deflected the kind of xenophobia that the mullahs have in the context of completing the nuclear project, which, don't forget, has been going on for close to two decades, and potentially, if necessary, using it as kind of a last-day scenario in furtherance of their goals.
My comment would be that utter defeat of Hamas and Hezbollah would do far more to inhibit Iran than sanctions.
Good point, Fred.
Because they're next.
John?
Yeah, you know, I think Ken raises a number of interesting points, but I think we have to all bear in mind that, you know, Iran uses its proxies to really run interference and to draw our attention away from its nuclear program. They did this with Hezbollah in 2006. I believe they're doing it now. You know, every time there's a lull in political events, you know, Iran finds a way of drawing attention away from its nuclear program towards one of its proxies. And we're beginning to see frustration on the part of the Sunni nations, which is what you were referring to. And there, as I understand it, there have been some back-channel discussions, you know, where Sunni nations and Israel are finding common ground in that they're both, you know, very afraid of seeing Iran go nuclear. Unfortunately, to this day, we've not really seen the kind of cooperation that we'd like to see. I mean, Saudi Arabia still sees Israel as an enemy. Really, so does Egypt, despite the peace agreement that's in place. So it's not really overriding, it's not overriding their enmity towards one another, but it is something that could encourage them over time. But I'm not seeing it as really being an impetus to move against Iran.
I should add that the United States sees Iran also as an enemy. It's not just the Sunnis and the Israelis, but there's common cause with all of them, including the United States.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have one more question, then we're going to take a break. And Jerry, I'll have you finish out the last segment here with John and Ted. This is going to put you in the time machine, and this is a little aside from where we are right now. I have often remarked on my program to my audience about the fact that the world power has changed so significantly that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia could, in effect, demand a face-to-face audience with Vice President Cheney. I'm sure you remember when he flew all the way to Riyadh for a one-hour meeting. I mean, that was the only thing he came there for, was a one-hour meeting. And as I seem to recall, it was at a time when the Sunnis were concerned. This gets back to my Shiite-Sunni balance here. That it appeared as though that very well maybe the Shiites were going to go for blood revenge and take the Sunnis out, and that the speculation was that Saudi Arabia was telling Mr. Vice President Cheney there will be some sort of intervention or something like that. But it's been long enough that by now, with y'all's connections, with your connections, excuse me, I slipped into my Southern English there, with your connections, what was that meeting about, and what is the significance of it as far as the United States and our relationship to the Middle East?
I'll just briefly address that. You know, this was there are a couple things at play. You know, number one, Saudi Arabia was seen as critical to helping to stabilize Iraq. and to perhaps work against Iran. And also, it's, you know, this is probably at a time when oil was at a much higher level, and you know, these were all major concerns of the United States at a time when the vice president was very active in foreign policy. I think that you know, with the neutralizing or stabilization, let's say, of Iraq, the drop in oil prices, I don't think you have as much pull as you once had in Saudi Arabia, and I think that's probably a good thing. It's not to say that the United States sees Saudi Arabia as a pivotal ally and gives it a free pass on a number of, you know, huge issues such as the spread of Wahhabi Islam and radicalization across the region, but you know, I would say that it has considerably less influence today than it had at the time of that meeting.
All right, Ted,
there's another meeting that is quite important. When the United States was debating whether or not to bring on the surge, and it looked like the United States was leaning toward withdrawing, and the political pressure was enormous. Condi Rice went to the Arab states around the Gulf, and they dictated to her that you shouldn't be reducing troops, you should be increasing troops. So it's because of their threats to United States that they were demanding America do the surge as opposed to withdraw. The surge took place.
And Jerry?
The other element in this stuff is the risk of nuclear proliferation amongst the Sunni nations themselves. You've had more than ample evidence and communications from the Saudis and even from some of the Emirates and, I gather, Turkey about their desire to create their own, quote, nuclear capabilities. That would be a catastrophe in the context of the geopolitical aspects of the U.S. relations with the region if that occurred. Whether that's a reality or not is not clear. But currently, in the situation in Gaza, it would appear to me that the Sunnis are saying, look, Israel, you have your right to defend yourself and crush these people if you can manage it. We certainly would do that if it broke out, for example, in the eastern province in Saudi Arabia, which has a fairly significant Shiite population sitting on their lake of oil.
Gentlemen, I got to take a break. When we come back, Jerry Gordon, you'll head us up for the last segment. You're listening to Your Turn. 1330 AM WBY. West Florida's Talk Radio, Kenneth E. Lamb. I'm your host here today. Mallory Bardwell is our producer. We'll be back right after these words. Welcome back to our final segment for this hour. We'll be with you, of course, till 6 o'clock. We have Jerry Gordon with us here, Ted Bellman, live from Ontario, Canada. Ted is the editor of Israel Pundit. Thank you very much for joining us. John Salazar is with the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C., live from Washington. Jerry, I'm going to let you wrap it up. You've got 3.5 minutes. Go for it.
Well, in 3.5 minutes, I'll talk fast. But basically, John Shands, an attorney, wrote a book called Hamas versus Fatah. In the wake of this operation, what would happen essentially if Fatah came back after Hamas was destroyed?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about whether you know, Israel would try to install or reinstall Fatah as the leader or the guardian of the Gaza Strip. I think they would essentially, in a nutshell, be rejected by the population. Primarily because this would be Israel's wish. This would be sort of like a transplant. There'd be probably less than a 50% chance of it being accepted by the body of the Palestinians. And really, I think that what's been ignored primarily in the mainstream media coverage is that there really is this longstanding rivalry between Hamas and that's resulted in a civil war last year. And you will see that even after the pummeling of Gaza ends and Israel wraps up its military operations, there will still be violence between these two sides, and it will be, I think, a very long time before we really have an understanding of who the interlocutor is on the Palestinian side, which at the end of the day is what really complicates the peace process. It's not even Israeli-Palestinian problems, but we just don't even know who to talk to on the Palestinian side.
Ted, you want to wrap up in the context of your view about whether or not the two-state solution is even a thread of viability?
Well, first of all, the deal that's being presented to Israel and demanded of Israel to accept is such a horrible deal. Under no condition would I accept that deal. And besides which, we can never rely on the Palestinians to live by the deal. So my view is that the two-state solution is a bad idea. It will not come to fruition. It has come to fruition in close to 100 years. And other solutions have to be looked to.
Jerry, your chance to wrap it up. I got a minute for you.
All right. Well, I would like to say thank you to my colleagues from Jerusalem, Toronto, Washington, D.C. This has been a fascinating and constructive hour. I think this is really a kind of a breakthrough landmark session here on Your Turn on WEBY. And my thanks to both Mike Bates and particularly host Ken Lamb.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate it. And, Ted, I'm going to be sending some more stuff up to you, getting going again. So I'm looking forward to working with you and with Israel Pundit again. John, thank you very much. And if you'd be so kind, John, this is the first time I've ever gotten to talk with you is today. But if you would touch base with Jerry, please get me onto your mailing list. I will want you on as a guest again, just like we do with Jerry here. If we can do that.
Good pleasure.
Same thing with you, Ted, of course. All right?
Thank you.
All right, John. All right. Thank you all very, very much. Listen, that's going to wrap it up for this hour.